start a podcast. Yeah, start a podcast, they all said. How hard can that be?
All the gear and no idea, Dr. Cal.
I suppose we better do this thing professionally. Intro theme? Check. Irreverent banter?
Check.
And something about interviews.
Welcome to the very first shiny new Clem and Em podcast with me, Clemmy Stewart, and her, Dr. Emma Kell. Think of this as, well, two teachers who talk to people.
And each other, of course. I've been a teacher for 20 years in the state sector, head of department, and I've written the odd thing or two.
And I've been a teacher for over 10 years now, currently head of two prep schools in London. I'm also governor of an academy school in London too.
Excellent. So why are we doing this, Clemmy?
That's a very good question, which I've been asking myself for a little while, but we're doing it to explore the world of education, but in a far more broad and exciting way than perhaps just looking at pure education as teachers thinking about education. So we're looking at different people from different fields, different parts of the world who want to explore the impact education had on them and also what they would do if they were in charge of schools for the day.
I think we're also doing it because we're really nosy about people though, aren't we?
Definitely.
I just love talking to people. I love talking to people about schools. I love talking to people about what made them feel vulnerable at school, about how naughty they were at school, about their worst teachers, their best teachers. And I think a bit like you say, you know, you and I have both spent a lot of time online. That's how we got to know each other, by the way. over cooking disasters, which we'll get into later on. So we've been talking to lots of other teachers who believe a lot of the same things that we believe about school and education. And someone said to me, a certain someone who we're going to speak to later in this podcast, she said, why don't you talk to people who don't already agree with you? Why don't you bring in people from outside with different experiences? I definitely listen to that.
Which I think is a really fair point. I think it's really easy in the world of education to get in our echo chambers and we keep telling each other how great we are and how we're totally on the right page. But actually, we really need some other people to test and stress test those ideas that we have to make sure that we are right in our thinking. And if not, make us go away and really question our own conscious and unconscious biases around the world of education.
We tend to, yeah, you can get a bit naive in your bubble, can't you? And it's important that we step outside. So we're going to be talking to some guests. Some are confirmed, some are possibles. It's all very, very exciting. We're going to be talking very soon to a young lady called Nalufa Hidayat, who now calls herself Nell because she's really cool now. I think of her as really young because I taught her. She's now a very famous documentary maker, goes all over the world. She's vegan and all sorts of cool things like that.
We've got some possible politicians who are brave enough to sign up and get asked some questions by people who don't have the script in front of them, which I think will be really, really interesting. People from the world abroad. Broadcasting as well have shown an interest in taking part, and we're also exploring links with sport too, which I think will be really important.
Yep, brilliant. And also obviously my specialism, literature. I've been stalking all of the authors. Mr. Rosen, please reply Michael Rosen, because we really, really want you on there. Fiona Miller, we might well have soon. And really excitingly, we've got confirmation from young adult author Patrice Lawrence, who wrote Orange Boy, which is a phenomenal book. And I can't wait to talk to her about young women and their confidence and their achievement and how they see themselves in school.
We're so lucky that so many of these people want to be involved in this project. And I think it just shows how much room there is out there for discussion about education and the impact it has on every single person's life, whether they enjoyed it, hated it, learned from it, detested it. We're going to be able to find out so much about the world of education. And I'm so excited. We'd love to hear from you. We're both on Twitter. So you can follow me at CStewartSHS, and you can follow Emma at Those That Can.
And please tell us about what you think about, for example, Labour's new education policy. Should Ofsted be abolished? Should we be abolishing private schools? How is your school different from schools today? And in this bizarre month of weird half terms, how are you spending yours? Are you getting some proper relaxation, or are you spending the whole time doing your displays? We look forward to hearing from you.
So let's kick this off then. It's obviously been an incredibly busy few weeks and months for education, even in the midst of Brexit and everything else that's been happening. There's been a lot of discussion about new ideas in education. As Emma said, getting rid of Ofsted, adding 20% onto independent school fees. There's an awful lot for us to unpick there.
There's another thing which seems to be on my radar all the time at the moment. I do feel like schools have completely gone insane when it comes to Ofsted. There seems to be this, I don't know if it's the same in your school, Clemmy, but there's this absolute hysteria at the moment over what Ofsted might possibly want to see or hear or learn about in school. So people are driving themselves absolutely nuts preparing implementation, or what's it called? What is it again, Clemmie? Intent implementation. No, what is it? I don't know.
Implementation, and then something else beginning with
impact.
Impact.
With three eyes. So people are driving themselves absolutely insane preparing that thing that we obviously understand incredibly well. But on a genuine note, I'm feeling really frustrated at the moment because I felt like we were starting to move in the right direction. Mm. I felt like I was hearing some news from teacher training institutions saying that numbers were up. There, you know, it wasn't perfect, but Ofsted were acknowledging that there was such a thing as teacher wellbeing and such a thing as unnecessary workload.
Yeah, and I think it'd be really interesting to speak to Amanda Spillman about this, because the sense I've certainly got from reading about her and hearing people reflecting on her, that was never her intention. You know, it was absolutely trying to take workload in the opposite direction, and yet somehow it seems to have been interpreted in such a way that it's now driving that workload and letting those Ofsted out, you know, and factors drive curriculum rather than curriculum driving Ofsted. And I think that's a real disappointment if that's the case.
Yeah, it feels like some weird catch 22 where Ofsted have said, they've said they don't want people to prepare extra stuff. They've said they want to see it as it really is. But as someone said to me on Twitter the other day, it's a bit like telling someone not to tidy up before the in-laws come round. Everyone's going to. Some people will do a full spring clean and some people will just empty the ashtrays. But
yeah,
I don't know. It's really frustrating though, because I'm already getting teachers coming to me saying they've had enough. So I'm slightly obsessed with finding schools and leaders who are resisting that pressure. And I really want to hear from you actually, so that we can share some of those positive stories, but also not just share in a fluffy way, but actually say to people, you know, there is another way. There really is another way of doing things. And we don't have to be shackled by this.
I thought it was fascinating, Emma, when you put out your tweet about that. And normally you get so many responses to your tweets. And I think people were really nervous of responding to that one. And in fact, I thought of a head straight away that I work very closely with, who I know would be fantastic to talk to you about that, but I'm scared of sharing his name in case it's deemed to be inappropriate. So I think there's some work to do around sort of Big Brother and everything in that sense of Ofsted as well, and people just taking that pride back and that strength and that leadership.
So there is tons to talk about, and as you will realize, Clemmie and I can both, if nothing else, we can talk. So we have our big girl pants on, we are being 10% braver, and we are doing this. So in every podcast, we'll be talking to people who can bring an interesting perspective on teaching. They're not all teachers, they're not all in education. In fact, our first guest is a woman who is at the top of her game, an award-winning journalist, a mother of three, and a controversial commentator. Camilla Tominey is the associate editor of The Telegraph. And in between covering Brexit and the latest japes of the royal family, she popped over for tea and a chat. Right, so fabulous. We're here to talk about school.
Yes.
Now, I have to say, Camilla partly gets credit for this whole idea. We're only sitting here because of you. It's all your fault.
Not really, because you've engineered it now. So that's the good thing.
So we're here to talk to you about, broadly speaking, your school.
Yes.
A little bit, a few revelations, please, if you're
yes,
up for that.
Yes, of course, no problem.
And then a little bit about how you, as a very successful journalist, yes. How you see schools today and what your views are.
All right, cool. No problem at all. I mean, it's funny because only recently I was at the Labour Party conference and I was on Politics Live with Laura Pidcock, a Labour MP, and some other panellists. And it was just as Jeremy Corbyn had announced that abolish Eton policy and this idea of scrapping private schools. And because I also play football with a bunch of, I would say, quite left-leaning women, we had had this debate and I was the only private school girl on the bus to the football, and I was rounded on by a great many girls on the bus who were saying, you know, it's too privileged, etc. And then on that panel, Laura was sort of saying, you know, you seem to be taking this very personally. And what she was implying there is, well, you went to private school and I want to expose that on the telly. And I said, I've got no problem with saying I went to private school, which I did from the age of seven. So I was brought up in Harpenden and I went to Roundwood JMI when I was five for a couple of years. And then I was always destined to go to St Albans High School for Girls. And that was because my grandmother taught there. So I think my parents had it in mind. I got two older brothers. They at the time were at a prep school, Beechwood, over quite near us. And so at seven, that was it. I was going to go to private school and I knew I was going to be there till 18, which is probably a strange thing for people to think, because I know people chop and change. But that consistency suited me well. And But I remember going from the JMI, I was quite behind, and I had to go and have lessons with my grandma to pass the entrance test. And I remember on arrival at school, I thought, oh my God, I'm one of the lowest in the year here.
And did you feel different?
Yes, I did.
And because, you felt that difference?
Well, I just felt, I didn't feel stupid, but I really recognised the fact I was behind. And I remember teachers who were quite strict in comparison to what I'd been used to, like the private system, didn't seem to take any prisoners. And I remember being on GIN books. I don't know if you remember them as teachers.
Yes,
GIN.
I do.
And I was on the lowest level. And I remember looking across to other girls thinking, oh my God, people are way ahead of me. And the funny thing about my school career is I feel that from the beginning to the end, it was a literally clawing myself up to try and be as good as the other girls. So even in junior house, you went through 4 years and then you all sat an entrance exam to get into the senior school, and everyone got a letter back. And some of my friends got a letter back saying they had done very well. And I remember we just got a letter back saying, yes, she's passed. But there was no like commendation on the letter. So even when I went into secondary school, and I think they've changed it now, and actually some girls are told, well, don't bother coming to the senior school, which is something I don't agree with. And I'll get onto that when it comes to my where I have educated the children so far. But no, I got through, and it was only really until about the third year. So what's that, year 7, 8, 9 in new money, that I started coming into my own in English, which is probably a pivotal factor in me becoming a journalist.
Absolutely.
So if you had gone to a state school, let's imagine some of the more, I don't know, more down-to-earth, rough comprehensives around here, do you think your life would have turned out differently?
Yeah. I think I was always quite a robust person. What I was good at, even though I was never the cleverest at school, and I was never the least academic either, I was in the middle, I was a grafter, and I was a character. And I think I had two older brothers, so I didn't really miss boys, so I was in a single-sex school. I wonder whether the influence of boys would have helped me or hindered me, to be honest. What was quite good is I was quite an alpha girl in a girls' school, and that meant that I had quite good banter and that I was quite confident. So I spent a lot of my senior school doing a lot of drama, a lot of debating. If someone had to be pushed forward to make a point with one of the teachers, it would be me. Oh, Camilla, why don't you say to the history teacher, we need to do X, Y, and Z? I wasn't really afraid of authority figures. I was respectful of them because that was the culture of the school. But I was the one who would ask the question. I was the one who, and in a way, that was my that was in turn my training to be a journalist.
And how did the teachers respond to that? Because again, some teachers like to be challenged and like to be stretched, and others really don't.
Well, I remember like some ridiculous banter. Like one teacher who was quite this upright head of sixth form. I was walking down the corridor. I mean, I can't believe this now. I was walking down the corridor eating a banana, and she said to me, Camilla Tominey, what are you going to do with that banana? And I actually did reply, bend over and I'll show you. Which on reflection, is not the thing you turn around and say to the head of sixth form when you're in lower sixth. She actually laughed and thought it was quite funny. I had other occasions where our history teacher, who was this lovely, lovely lady who had the neatest handwriting, she said to me,
you remember that,
in upper sixth, something like, Camilla, you're not your normal ebullient self today. And I remember turning around and saying, yeah, I'm overworked and undersexed. And again, all the girls were like, what is she talking about? It was just brazen. There was a degree of banter that I felt I introduced, and mostly they took it well. I think the great thing about that school was it was very much an environment where we weren't even talked about as if, oh, you're a girl, so. There was no caveating of you're a girl. It was just, right, this is what we expect from you and you will achieve your absolute best. There are no barriers for you. You just go and do it. And I felt that failure wasn't an option. That was the culture of the school. That sounds like hothousing, and it wasn't, because a lot of my friends weren't as academic, and some of them did quite patchily in their A-levels, but they've all gone on. But it was this sense of, I mean, if you got lower than a B, you regarded yourself as not having done very well. And in the circumstances that I had personally at home in my family life, I had an extremely privileged upbringing, and my father was a GP and my mum was a housewife. We lived in this lovely big house in Harpenden, but I had problems at home because my mother was an alcoholic and she wasn't exactly, I would say, tuned into school life. She wasn't the kind of mum who was a soccer mum coming to support me in sport. To be fair to her, she did used to come and see my drama and plays because she was quite a creative spirit, and so she enjoyed that. And I reflect on it, I'm really glad that I was in a school environment that did all the heavy lifting, because if I'd been in a state school and it had required more input from my parents, and this is no reflection on either of my parents, but my dad was on call 60 hours a week and was really busy, and my mum just, you know, her philosophy was, well, this is what we're paying for, so we'll leave you to it. And that self-sufficiency, I mean, I thank my lucky stars, because there was a period when I basically, my parents divorced when I was 13 or 14. I went to live with mum by myself. My dad went and lived with the boys because they didn't want to live with mum, but I felt a sense of loyalty. So between GCSEs and A-levels, I was living by myself with an alcoholic. And if it hadn't been for the fact that my school had engendered in me this spirit of success and achievement, I could have gone completely the other way. What I did is I retreated into my work. So mum was problematic in the evenings, and I'd go off into my little bedroom and just get my work. I geekified myself as a protection mechanism. Now, this is not a reflection on the state system, but would I have? And by the way, my teachers at school didn't know this was going on.
I was going to ask what level of pastoral support you felt you had.
On one hand, you can then reflect and think, God, if I was in the state system, or if I was of a different social demographic, would we have had social services involved? Would I have been involved with CAMHS? You know, so the middle class nature of my mother's hidden addictions, rather than being like a heroin addict, you know, where you'd have every agency involved, there was a conspiracy of silence around this condition, so that I didn't discuss it with my teachers. But what I'm saying is the robust nature of the school structure, my father's guidance, like a very hard-working, well-educated, intelligent man. To be fair, my mother's influence in that, despite her alcoholism, a very forthright, very bright woman who, on reflection, should have had a career rather than being a housewife, but that's a podcast for another day. All these things contributed to me just knuckling down, because that was the environment I'm in. And what I'm saying is, if I was given an inch or two and I was in a different educational system that kind of went, oh, well, you know, you're having problems, so you just freewheel your way through your teenage years, I wouldn't have ended up studying law at Leeds University.
So was it a taboo? I mean, you've spoken quite openly about your mother. Was it a taboo then? Were your friends aware? Something that you were aware of needing to conceal?
Well, I wasn't aware of what it was until I got a bit older and realised I couldn't figure out why her mood kept on changing. And then I would discuss it with girls at school, saying stuff like, does your mum go a bit weird in the evenings? Or do you find yourself having to finish off the dinner? Or how much washing do you do a week? My girlfriends are like going, none. And I'm like thinking, oh, right, that's interesting, because I'm like ending up washing the boys' uniforms and getting stuff ready. And then it was when I was older and I started checking levels of alcohol bottles in the fridge, and I realised she had a problem. But I have to caveat it, and when I've written about this, you know, it's not all... It's a funny thing, alcoholism, you know. There's functioning elements to her life, and she'd come in for parents' evenings, and as I say, she'll come in for school plays. She wasn't around in the mornings very much, so we'd have to get ourselves to school. And then it was the archetypal, sort of slightly cliched, when you get home, what are you going to expect? But underneath all that, in sobriety, she's a very formidable, hilarious, brilliantly charismatic woman who wanted the best for all of her children and was certainly a champion of girls doing it for themselves. So in that sense, it's hard to reflect on it and think, well, how was I resilient? Is it because I am resilient? Is it because my parents, both of them in their different ways, and my brothers built resilience in me? How much did my school build resilience in me? But I would say on the latter, as we're talking about schools, it was a lot, because there is a culture of confidence in private schools, which is really important. And I reflect on how they built it up. And they built it up with things like, you know, the year three moment for English. My English teacher, Mrs. Reed, she printed out this poem I'd written. And I saw her come into the classroom with this, like, 24 or whatever was in the class of my poems, and she gave it out to everyone in the class, and she said, this is how you write poetry. And it was mine, and I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing that's happened to me. And stuff like that, that they do in, I mean, they might do that in all schools. You only know your own experience. Stuff like the drama teacher recognising in me that there was something to be channeled. And funny enough, I did a load of poetry when Mum was really ill. I wrote a hell of a lot. I became a writer to insulate myself from the situation. And again, I wonder if I hadn't had that encouragement in English and in drama, whether I would have felt that that was an appropriate thing to do. And equally, by the way, if I had had boys in the class, would I have been embarrassed by my poetry being handed out as opposed to really proud?
Are your children in single-sex schools now?
So my eldest is in a single-sex school and my other two are in a mixed school. But so I've got girl, boy, girl. My eldest is 11, Annabelle, so she's been in a single-sex private school now since she was six. And then Harry, my boy, I think will continue in co-ed. And then my youngest will probably join my eldest child in the single-sex school. And why I say that is because personally, just from personal experience, I feel that boys are benefited by girls from in class, but girls aren't benefited by boys.
Ooh. Interesting.
Oh, so well, Clemmie, you're head of a girls' school.
I'm head of a girls' school and head of a boys' school. So I find that really interesting. One of the big things we talk a lot at when we get asked about the impact of single-sex education for boys is compassionate masculinity. And I think that when the boys are all together, they are free to have that compassionate masculinity and not be playing the alpha male to other girls, which is quite interesting. But I know as well, when we talk to them, they tend to say, well, it'd be quite nice to have girls at school, whereas when we ask the girls, they're like, no, we absolutely don't want boys, we like learning, we like not being distracted. And it's fascinating to get their take on it, but they only got to 11.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
but then this is typical for me, because why I'm in this situation is the fact that I'm a single-sex educated girl with two boys who are in a single-sex school, married to a man who was in a single-sex school.
Yeah.
So I do think a lot of schooling is your own personal experience.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, because I went, did we all go to single-sex girls' school? Oh, you didn't,
I went to co-ed. I went co-ed all the way through.
Oh, okay. See, that's really interesting.
And so my first experience of single-sex schools is leading them.
See, I'm the complete opposite. Yeah. Right, so I went to single-sex. So I was brought up in Buckinghamshire, two-tier system, which, astonishingly to me anyway, still exists in 2019. So we passed or failed the 12 plus, and I passed, and I went to an all-girls school. And I don't know whether I'm being the opposite of rose-tinted, whatever that is.
So there's some background noise because somebody's whistling quite happily in the background. If anyone listening can hear that.
Having a cheery.
A couple of better ones in life. One of them's public whistling, the other one's public bagpipes. Carry on. Carry on.
I got it. Worst the things in life.
Yeah.
What was I going to say?
I've
completely lost my thread now. Yeah, now I don't know whether I'm being spoiled little middle class girl or what, but my memories of my schooling are not happy at all. It was very much high-achieving all-girls school. I remember it as being quite bitchy. I remember it as being very difficult to establish myself in a friendship group. I was very defensive. I remember myself, and I don't know whether this is a perception or reality, but as being quite quiet, quite withdrawn, which obviously I'm not at all nowadays. So I almost made a vow to myself when I became a teacher. I'm still happy. Should we join in?
Shall I live up to my reputation of just going up and going, excuse me, mate?
So this is a bit like generations, isn't it? I flew in the face of that. So when I became a teacher, which was always inevitable, I said to myself, I will never work in single sex and my children will never go to single sex, which is almost what you're saying, isn't it? I suppose we base it, but I resisted my experience, whereas you actually ran with yours.
But this is like childbirth. I mean, if it's gone well for you, you recommend it. Oh, midwife-led unit, it's perfect. You don't need an epidural. Then someone else goes, what are you talking about? Take the drugs. In fact, have a cesarean. This is all about personal experience. Having said that, I would agree with you that I do think that, and I don't know if alpha is the right word to use, but there is a more alpha environment in a private school where it is a little bit more competitive and survival of the fittest, and therefore the characters that throw themselves into and are probably confident to begin with every aspect of school, drama, sport, debating, oh, D of E, I'll sign up for that, which was the kind of kid I was and my eldest child is, which is why I chose it for her, thrive. Do I agree that more quiet, creative kids might get left behind in such a system, maybe. But then I'm relating that back to an 80s system, and the school I chose for my eldest, I took my eldest back to my old school, and I chose not to send her there because I wanted an environment where, which is what I've chosen for her, where it is a mixed ability. So if you're an academic child, they nurture it. If you're not, and you're brilliant at non-academic subjects, go and do them. And they'll literally offer any GCSE or A-level, they will facilitate it. I'd like to do Mandarin. I'd like to do performing arts. And as a journalist, weirdly, I had this really prescriptive route because my father has umpteen degrees and my mother was the child of educationalists. Both of her parents were teachers. Her brother was a teacher. I had this path straight to university. That was what was expected. A's and B's, 2-1, or first if you can get it. But being a journalist now, I've realised you didn't need that. And if a child turned, I really hope I will live up to this promise. But I'd like to think that if a child turned around to me, I'd like them to get their A-levels and said, oh, Mum, I want to be a journalist. Do I need to go to university? I will have the courage to say, no, you don't. I will help you set you up with a news agency or whatever, because you didn't need a degree to be a journalist and you don't need a degree to get on in life. And that's wasn't really explained to me at school. Another stuff that isn't explained, like, oh, by the way, do you know that if you go and do a law degree and you end up being a lawyer working 80-hour weeks and you want a family, that's going to prove really challenging for you. No one says that in careers advice to women, do they?
No.
So true. And I think that there's such a difficulty now where we know that we're preparing children for a world that none of us have lived in, none of us fully understand, with technologies that don't exist yet, with jobs and routes that will be so different and so unique to each child. You ask children now what they want to be. One told me the other day they want to be an influencer.
Oh,
a role that parents might not even understand or know. And so we're having to be so much more broad in terms of our offering, and our curriculum has to look far more at those skills around presentation, pitching, being creative, turning an idea into something that actually works, rather than we were doing 4 A-levels, which one of those do you want to read at a Russell Group University?
Yeah. But also that character stuff. We take kids for a work experience to be journos, and you know the most academic ones aren't very good because they don't have chutzpah and spontaneity. Yeah. They are prescriptive kids who have to get their heads down and can't quite adapt to changing situations. That idea of agility, this ability to quickly adapt, which is what journalism is all about. I mean, one minute, you know, you're interviewing a prince, the next you're sort of talking to a toilet cleaner, trying to find out what's happened in a nightclub. It is that diverse, and that ability to speak to everyone. I mean, that isn't something that you learn doing a degree. But what's interesting is, are we a generation that's a hang-up of my parents? The dual system, weirdly, as I have, this sounds hypocritical, I'm sure, because I have had selective education and I've chosen selective education, but that secondary modern versus grammar, which appeared to be the obsession of my parents' generation, and whether they'd gone to grammar school and what happened to the secondary modern, I remember being brought up on a lot of that, you know. And it wasn't, my parents were both grammar school kids. Well, great, lucky them, you know. Both of their parents were brought up on council estates, and you know, they made the jump and my parents made the climb, and they were then professionalised classes. But you just had to think to yourself, well, what happened to the secondary modern kids, and why was it so frowned upon? Oh, well, you didn't get into grammar school. That depresses me. I always think that if we were going to have two types of system in this ever-changing world of ours, why don't we have places where kids do very academic subjects, they want to be doctors and lawyers and do the serious, in inverted commas, and then say to kids who want to do, and I don't just mean, by the way, being electrician or plumber, because frankly that's a bloody great thing to do, and actually if any child turned around and said they wanted to do that, I'd go, great, you're going to earn good money. But why not have, instead of this, oh, this is better and this is less, have all the cool subjects in another technical school and have them do T-levels in journalism, computer science, physical education, all of these great careers, that these are the careers people want, and then that would be more valued, wouldn't it?
But if you're going to do that, aren't you still... It sounds very much like the German system. So the German system, I remember going over there when I was at Oxford doing my PGCE, and someone said to me, what do you do? And I said, I'm a student at Oxford. And he said, what do you do? He said, I'm an electrician. And there was no kind of, absolutely no sense that anyone was superior to anyone else from a class point of view. But if you do have that vocational versus academic, A, when do they decide? B, can they move across? Are they restricting themselves if they go up one route or the other?
Yeah.
It's a really difficult one, isn't it?
But I'm just saying it would even up slightly this idea of, yes, there are some kids out there that are grade A students and they're going to be curing cancer and sending more people to the moon and all the rest of it. And for God's sake, let's give them the best education they can. But for the round pegs and square holes out here, and a lot of them, I mean, there are, of course, some very, very highly educated people in journalism. But you look at a publication like The Spectator, you know, the editor Fraser Nelson just does an aptitude, he doesn't care where you, what your qualifications are. You do an aptitude test, can you write good copy? And there are a lot of professions, frankly, where I don't think it makes any difference at all whether you've got A's at A-levels or whatever in your degree. Can you actually do this job? They had Grant Thornton did a study where they took non-graduates into their sales and marketing team and woe betide, you know, oh, what a shock. The non-grads, the straight out of school leavers, were much better at sales and marketing than the kids who had done degrees.
So these exams we get so hung up on, these grade fours, these five passes and everything else. How, I mean, I suppose this takes us to, you know, what if you could change the system,
well,
what would you change?
Well, I think you've got to change the attitudes of parents and employers. We've got to change this attitude. And obviously there are some professions and vocations for which the qualifications are needed, medicine being one. You know, we do want people to know what they're doing. But we need to change this attitude whereby employers' first port of call is a degree. And we need to change that. If we change that attitude of employers, then it will change in parents, and then parents will be going to the children who are the round pegs in the square holes, or perhaps the children, and there's plenty of them out there, let's face it, who for whom university is just a couple of years too early. These are the kids who might benefit from being in work for a while, figuring out what they want to do, and then at 25 saying, that's it, I've got it, I want to be a teacher, I'm going to go and do a PGCE. To get children, some children aren't ready. I mean, were we all ready? I don't think I was, really.
No, and I think the most powerful thing my parents let me do was change my mind. So I left B-Dales and was supposed to go to Bristol to read music and was given a gap year and was told if I did that gap year, I had to do something with music to keep my place. So I taught music in a school, realised I absolutely hated music, had no desire to continue studying it for 4 years and instead went to be a teacher. And it was the most powerful decision. And the fact my parents supported me and let me do that meant that I could follow the right path for me. If I had gone to Bristol to read music, as amazing as Bristol is in music, I'm sure would have been fab, I would have dropped out. And I would have then been that person who had failed massively in that first big step of my independent life. And instead, my parents supported me to make that justified choice. And I've never looked back.
Although that choice, that kind of like you drop out of something, I'm not a quitter. You know, that mentality, which again is quite post-war. I think a recent study suggested that kids of our children's generation will have 17 different jobs in their life, right? Mm. Rather than, I mean, I appreciate we've gone past the days of people just having a job for life because that's more our parents' generation. But then why aren't we being a bit more flexible in our thinking? Why aren't we as adults saying, yeah, well, life does change and the career that you had up until you had children might not be the career that you want afterwards? Or why can't we turn around to men who might have gone straight into, I don't know, the banking sector and then after 20 years gone, hang on a minute, I'm just flashing my life away and not seeing my kids. I'd like to retrain as a gardener. And yet there's still this societal kind of pointing at fingers. Oh, you can't hack it. You know, society is very harsh on people that want to change career.
Yeah, and actually, and one of the most inspirational things I've been doing recently is working with this group called Now Teach, who are people who are in their 40s, 50s, even early 60s, who've had successful careers. My favourite was the missing the astronaut.
Oh, brilliant,
And actually are retraining to be teachers, and they've got so much to bring. And I think in teaching, we are a little bit stuck in this, you know, you stick with it for 40 years, you do your time, and if you quit, but that whole idea that people can come in at a different point. And actually, I mean, I very much went through the sausage machine. I loved studying. I was quite a good girl. I did what I was told. I went through the sausage machine. But our producer, my husband, Rav, hated university, got to university, got involved with radio, and then went from there, left university and became the youngest executive producer in the country while I was still faffing around with beans on toast and pasta.
I think it's role modelling. What we're talking about is role modelling, because again, I've just made the link and I don't know why it's taken me 34 years to make the link, but my dad dropped out of university. He didn't finish his degree because he was offered a job to be a reporter for a local news company.
Perfect.
And 40 years plus, I think he's probably made the right call there. But that made it okay for us to change our mind and follow our... And he was advised by his father to just take the opportunity, and if you go back, go back.
But I would say Bristol or something too. I would say this as well. I think that university is misrepresented as some kind of nirvana when for a lot of people it really isn't. I remember getting into university and, my God, like for the first 3 months, I mean, I was depressed. I was depressed. I was so homesick, I can't tell you. It was actually embarrassing. God love her, Abby, one of my closest friends. I remember being in my Vauxhall Nova and I was meant to be driving to campus and I was like veering off to the M1. Like I just wanted to, I was in Leeds, just wanted to get back down south. And I remember her saying, we're not going on the M1, get into campus. And it was because I'd been in the same school. So this is perhaps a disadvantage of my education. I'd been in the same school since I was 7. I was a big fish in a small pond. I knew everyone, they knew me. And I went to university and it was like, who am I? No one gives two hoots who I am or what I'm doing. You're just going to Sasha's. Is this allowed? Sorry, we're being interrupted by my son and his friend, Emma's daughter.
You can come and say hello.
Hello.
Well, there we go.
Mad people. So university, I found a grind, but again, Camilla went into default. Keep your head down. Get stuck in.
We've now got faces at the window.
Yeah. They're eating
with
strange
chewing gum. Who gave them chewing gum?
They've obviously gone to the news agents and just bought a load of toxic waste and some other e-number induced.
Is this hashtag parenting fail?
This it is.
Hashtag enjoy it tonight.
Yes, exactly. Hashtag not going to get them down till 10:30.
Hashtag I don't have children.
Hashtag, we live on couscous and spirulina.
Yes, of course we do.
Honestly, girl.
My children never have sweets. So basically, uni wasn't great. So I would love to say to kids, all right, do you know what? If you don't want to go to university, seriously consider other options. But employers have to provide the other options. And I think there have been problems with the rollout of apprenticeship schemes. And I think the big companies can do them because they can afford to lose them for a year in study and then bring them back into the company in the second year. But small to medium-sized businesses, which, by the way, could provide a brilliant place of work for young people, they can't afford that first year in study. And so that apprenticeship programme, it needs to be made better, it needs to be improved, and it needs to be heralded with statistical proof.
It needs to be
proof.
Attractive.
Well, it also needs to say, the government, and there are, I've written stories about this, there are stats to suggest that kids who are going into apprenticeships are earning more than graduates in the, after 5 years. They haven't got any student debt, they're sometimes renting or nearly got their foothold on a new home, they've got a deposit ready for a new home, they're driving their own company car. It's a great life, you know.
There is a gap here in how we train teachers, isn't there? Because it's going to sound awful, but as a teacher of 21 years, I wouldn't have a clue how to advise my 16-year-olds on what kind of apprenticeships might or might not be available for them. My head is still very much in, Exeter's nice.
No.
And actually, it's how we get teachers in touch. Because actually, this whole coming back to this thing of teachers have to be teachers for 30 years, if teaching's all you've ever known, how on earth are you going to advise young people on the real world?
But isn't this also the argument for better careers advice? Now, this whole idea of, the PE teacher comes and does a bit of careers advice on a Tuesday afternoon when you're in your lower six. Hang on a minute. First of all, what does Mr. Smith in his tracksuit know about careers in any other profession other than his own? Point one. Point two, this is a box ticking. This is really important. We should have dedicated careers advisor in every school who knows what they're talking about, who's had a life in employment, and actually some mentoring from outside companies who might want to talk through what kids want to do with their lives. Encourage them that it's not the end of the world if they don't know yet, but equally to have that dedicated focus. And I think, you know, work experience needs to be meaningful. This is where parents come in. For God's sake, parents, provide work experience. If you're doing a great job, I'm really lucky. I'm working at the Telegraph, right? Loads of kids want to come and have a look at journalism. They literally think they're going to be the next Lois Lane or Superman. And actually, most of the time, that's true. It's I couldn't be more passionate about my career. I love, love, love it. So the more kids that are interested in that want to come in, I'm literally facilitating about one a day, but one day in politics at the moment is basically enough for 2 months' work experience.
Oh, yeah,
from the morning to of the evening, you know, like being in Parliament with these kids, their eyes are on stalks.
Yeah. On stilts. I like eyes on stilts.
Yeah,
eyes on
stilts. Oh, look, there's Boris Johnson. Oh, look, there's Jerry Corbyn. You'll love this, Emma. You know, who do they want the selfie with? Who do you think they want the selfie with?
It must be Boris.
Oh, it's Boris, isn't it?
No, it's the other one. Corbyn. It's your other favourite, no?
Gove.
Very tall, very posh, sometimes lounges in the House of
Jacob
Commons.
Rees-Mogg.
Oh. Rees-Mogg.
They want a selfie with Jacob Rees-Mogg.
They all do.
Do they ever get it?
Yeah. Do selfies with anyone. It's like the most approachable MP on the parliamentary estate. You see,
brilliant.
We try and get Jacob Rees-Mogg in here because I tell you what, after half an hour, you will basically be Genghis Khan. You will literally change your entire political outlook, having
She's
been persuaded.
Left-leaning me.
Having been persuaded in the politest terms of all of the Conservative arguments.
Yes, maybe we'll try that one.
We will try.
Mr. Rees-Mogg.
I'll put a word in.
If you're listening,
can talk about his Eton
come
days.
And convert me.
And how he's going to privately educate all of his six children.
Cure me of my left-leaning views.
Well,
yes.
I'd love this. I would pay to see that.
Yeah. I'm making a diary note.
Just coming back, there was something you said earlier about confidence. I'm fascinated by confidence. And I love teaching. I've always taught in the state sector. And actually, yeah, I've never taught in the independent sector. So I'm not in a position to in any way judge one way or the another. But one of our frustrations is actually building the confidence of our students. And it drives me batshit crazy when I'm in front of a class and I ask a question and all the boys are there with their hands up. And the number of times I've stood there and said, oh, we burnt our bras for this.
Yeah.
It's 2019, yeah. Girls, for God's sake. Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? And girls not asking
some
questions.
Might call it a sense of entitlement, and it does rub people up the wrong way. But where does that? Because I think of those top private schools in the country, and I can picture the boys now in Highgate walking around, and they almost own the street, don't they? You know, they command such absolute attention, and it makes me bristle. But at the same time, what you're talking about, the girls that you were educated with, the woman they helped you become at that school. How do we instill that confidence in the state sector? Because it's not there. I mean, maybe in some schools, but in a lot of the schools I've known, it's not there. It's a classic, girls sit there, wait for the boys to answer.
Well, I think there is a lot of independence installed very, very early on. And I don't know whether that's the case in the state system when one perhaps has the false impression, but the general impression, it might be a bit more modelly coddling and a bit more sort of involved, maybe quite rightly from a safeguarding perspective, but they give you very, very free rein to kind of organise your life very early in private school, which is quite daunting. It's a bit of a being thrown in the deep end situation. Equally, I mean, confidence is built out of opportunities. It's funny you're talking about, the Etonians walking around Slough. They're the ones who own the streets. Well, are they, or actually is it gang members and intimidating kids on bikes, right?
Do Etonians walk around Slough or do Etonians walk around Eton?
Well, okay, let's say they walk around Windsor, right? And I've done a lot of work in Windsor. So there'll be some Etonians walking around in Windsor and they'll have supremacy, but so will gangland kids on their bike type teenagers. And what do both of those sets of kids have in common, even though they are probably demographically completely diverse? And I suppose it's this sense of hierarchy. I mean, on one hand, in Eton, I suppose they are educated to think that they are the cream of the crop, rightly or wrongly. And when it comes to kids on the street, there is a hierarchy with regard to kind of age and supremacy and location, which means that there are some kids that you don't mess with. Now, that's born out of a strange kind of like societal survival instinct, isn't it?
But one of those groups has choices and one of those groups doesn't.
Precisely. But so this is the difference, isn't it? And I remember to name drop, sorry, catch it now, when I interviewed Bear Grylls.
Oh.
Now, love him. That's a subject for another podcast.
Clemmie's met Colin Firth, so
there we have it. So when I met Bear Grylls, he was saying, you know, what this is about, because I was talking about could the scouts go into gangland communities and recruit? And I said, don't be ridiculous. Of course they could.
Get mugged.
You get mugged, maybe. And he goes, well, hang on a minute. No, because gangs, it's all about a uniform. It isn't a woggle, but it's about belonging and it's about teamwork. You know, there's a fraternity about Eton, and there's a fraternity about being on the street. And he was also saying, but the difference, of course, is a lack of opportunity. So he would turn around to some kids on an estate and say, has anyone here ever climbed a mountain? And no hands would go up. Although if you say to the same kinds of kids, regardless of their background, who here wants to climb a mountain, particularly teenage boys, it's going to be dangerous. We may get injured. We're going to have some equipment. And I don't even know if we'll get to the top, let alone get to the bottom. But who's with me? He says it's very hard. There's no children, really. And let's not forget teenagers are children who say, no, I don't want to do that. But half of them have never been in the countryside or ever been offered the chance. So that's the difference. But perhaps we're veering off the original. Confidence for me in school was, would you like to do drama? Would you like to do some extra drama? Would you like to stand up in front of class and help present an assembly? Would you like the opportunity to represent the school in debating? I will say the other thing about confidence, and this is what worries me a bit about modern day schooling, and I hope you're not going to jump on me, Emma, but sometimes I make the arguments from my political perspective of being on the right and a Brexiteer, because I feel
she said it.
Somebody drop a spoon. There's somebody. There is somebody on the right.
Somebody might throw a spoon.
Who is a Brexiteer having a civilised conversation with a couple of teachers. But
one of whom is on the left.
One of whom. And I say on the right, that just means slightly right of centre. And some of my views are actually quite left of centre because we're all nuanced. But this is the point. It depresses me.
That's where we bond.
Right. It depresses me if we aren't having these arguments and that kids aren't having these arguments in school, right? The whole point about debating and getting into university and doing the same and law degrees was, you know, oh, right, you don't believe what I believe. Mm. What do you believe and why do you believe it?
Yep.
And I had an experience, I won't mention where I was, but I had an experience recently where I had to do a talk at a school and a child put their hand up and asked me whether I'd met Donald Trump. And I said, well, I haven't met him, but I was at a press conference with him because I'd covered Chequers when he came last year, meet Theresa May. And they said, what was he like? And I said, he was actually quite funny. And a teacher stepped in and went, well, I don't think we want to hear about that. Oh. And I thought, hang on a minute. I'm not saying that I don't think the guy is an a-hole of the highest order. But the
this
child,
is being recorded, yeah?
The child has asked me. I think we can say a-hole.
Okay.
But the child has asked me, and that was my honest appraisal. It was one of the funniest performances by a politician I've ever seen in my life, yeah? We need to be able to have these arguments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do worry sometimes, and you can counteract this, that we're not just teaching our children what to think, but how to think, and that really bothers me. I don't want kids saying, well, I actually think that capitalism isn't a bad idea, because like the alternatives like haven't really worked out very well. And I like Greta Thunberg, but I don't know if this is the right way to go about it and be closed down by teachers going, you don't know what you're talking about. And indeed pupils. We must have these open, and you know, this no platforming at universities. And it's not just if you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. There's a narrative of if you don't agree with me, then you're wicked. I can't bear that.
There's got to be that space and that safety to discuss and debate and challenge. And in fact, in independent schools, you're assessed by the independent schools inspectorate. And they actually ask the children about whether they have any political leanings that they have heard from their teachers. And we're absolutely not allowed to give any political leanings. Mm. But I would say it's a fundamental aspect of our role as educators to have them talking about it and showing them how to debate and showing them how to argue effectively and challenge each other respectfully and test out different ideas. Because if they can't do it in school, where it is a safe and structured space, where you can teach children how to do that, then when will they do it? Because they're not going to get it from social media either.
See, I mean, one of the most brilliant state schools I've ever worked at, state schools, I was working at when 9/11 happened and 7/7 happened. I was at school on those days. And I remember our head teacher standing up the next day and saying, I know this is difficult. I know everybody in this community is traumatised, but talk about it. Talk to your students. Let them say what they need to say. You know, use your professional judgment, but talk to them. It's slightly different, but it was deeply uncomfortable. Obviously, teachers of all sorts of races, religions, teachers who had families living very close to where it all happened. And it's slightly different to what you're saying, but actually the best state schools do promote those kinds
but
of dialogues. And we're not supposed to give
no,
up.
I
we
know.
Are not supposed
and
to
there
give
is,
up.
I know, but then even at my school...
Sometimes
I remember,
there's a wink and a...
Yes, but do you know what? Funny enough, I remember at my private school when the day Thatcher was ousted, and I remember I was in the corridor upstairs outside the staff room, and I remember one of the teachers going, "She's gone, she's finally gone." And like, it was like a high five moment. And it really confused me. It really confused
That's
me
so
because
funny. I, had exactly
I was
the same,
I was a child of Thatcher. I mean, my parents were Thatcherites, and and I looked at this and I thought, hang on, you know, we're in a private girls' school in the home counties, and you're high-fiving this.
But she truly jumped the shark by then.
I know,
she?
But I was about, I don't know, what year would that have been? 1992? God, I should know this.
Don't look at us, you're younger than us.
So I would have been about 11 or 12, and I wasn't au fait with the nuances of... I wasn't au fait with the nuances of, oh, she's gone a bit too far on Europe and the miners' strike. I just... You know, we'd grown up with Thatcher, and I she was an inspiration to me as a kid.
I had exactly the same situation because I boarded at my prep school, and I remember the day that Labour came in and absolutely took over, and I remember the head teacher coming up to me over breakfast as I was ladling my milk onto my cereal and just said, "It's a very dark day." And I had no idea.
But you had a ladle for your milk, which we didn't have in the States.
It's a silver ladle. Oh, my God. It wasn't really. But yeah, and I just remember thinking, should I know your political opinion? I find it really weird that you're telling me your political opinion. And maybe it was growing up in a house of, you know, the journalist where he has never in 40 years ever shown any bias because it's television rather than paper. I just remember thinking, I shouldn't know your opinion. I shouldn't. And why is it a dark day? I now need to go and find out much more about this. And that did stick with me. And that was a very long time ago.
Would you not agree there is a culture of quite rabid left-wingism in school?
I love the word rabid.
Well, usually it's applied to the right, so I thought I'd turn it on its head.
Rabid, yeah, actually, teachers don't talk about politics as much as you would imagine.
Yeah, but this is ridiculous. Everyone is informed. People's views inform their professional conduct.
There is a Twitter group called Tory Teachers. It's quite small.
There is.
Oh,
well, no, that's a good thing. But
I think.
I'm not saying that teachers are at fault. I think teachers are great. And actually, frankly, on the record, I think teachers should be paid more. I think that one of the fundamental problems, apart from not ploughing enough money into schools, and we've had it here, that funding formula was so catastrophic for the Conservatives at the last election, because I was in the playground down the road and people coming up to me because of what I do for a living going, "Well, is it true then the Tories are taking away free school meals from children?" I was going, "No, it's not quite like that." He goes, "But this school hasn't got enough money." And you kind of thought, no, it doesn't have enough money. Now, the counter-argument to that was Labour overfunded urban schools at the expense of rural, but you can't make that argument because then people go, "Well, we want all schools to be funded properly." So education and people's views about education very much does... I mean, the 2017 election was pivotal from the perspective that there were a lot of home counties mums that turned against the Conservatives or didn't vote, even though they're naturally right-leaning, not left, and frankly would not countenance some of Jeremy Corbyn's policies.
Similarly in teaching at the moment. I mean, I think post-Thatcher, political views of teachers were very clear because Thatcher alienated most of the teaching profession. I think we can probably agree on that. And so, broadly speaking, teachers were very much aligned. But I think in our current political blancmange, nobody quite knows which way they're facing anyway. No. So most teachers keep well away from it, and the staff are actually... We're too knackered to talk about politics, frankly.
Isn't and it interesting? Can't explain it. It's too complex to explain to the children. Yeah.
But isn't it interesting, though, that like Gove's educational reforms, which I know you all like bristle at the mention of...
See, I don't.
...are hugely appealing.
I don't
bristle. Not just not hugely appealing, have huge appeal, not just, if I may say, to... white middle-class people, because they are entrenchedly in support of the three R's and that kind of more robust approach, but also, by the way, with huge swathes of the BAME community, for whom education is absolutely foremost in how they bring up their children. And the robustness that we see in other countries, they want to be reciprocated here. And yet Gove is treated like this pariah when a great many parents are pro that more robust approach in the face of all stats and all the rest of it?
I don't think anyone's against the robust approach. I think it was the fact that it was done almost entirely without consultation with any teachers.
But then isn't that because they would never agree with it?
But that's not a reason not to...
with Tory education secretaries ever?
They're open to being I think anyone, people have egos, you know, people appreciate other people listening to them. So yeah. I think if I wouldn't care what political party, well, within reason, someone was from, if they said to me, come and talk to me about what you think,
yeah,
and we're getting together a group of educated teachers and we'd like, not educated, experienced teachers, and we'd like to talk to them about these new reforms, I think that would have people much more, and then other teachers would know that there'd been that level of consultation. Anyway, you were going to say, Clemmy, about Gove's reforms.
So I was working in a state school when Gove was Secretary of State for Education, and you couldn't say his name in the staff room without hiding behind a tatty old chair with egg stains on it. But I fundamentally believe in children having the best possible outcomes and schools providing that. So if you're going to raise standards and enable more children to achieve more, I'm fully behind it. But that made me very unpopular in the staff room.
I mean, the old system was deeply flawed. I don't think any teacher was standing there saying this combination of ridiculous amounts of coursework and, you know, that the system was perfect. It wasn't what was done. Well, it was elements of what was done. I mean, having every child sit a 2-hour, 15-minute exam for English and the forgotten third and everything else is wrong. But it wasn't what so much as how. Yeah, it was how. Teachers felt ignored. Teachers felt just sidelined, as if we weren't even worth talking to, because what could we possibly understand about education? And you've got these kind of politicians who've never actually been teachers themselves, who obviously know far more than we do. It was that
entrenched. If you think about the whole Labour position on private schools and this idea of abolishing Eton and all the rest of it, you know, surely the best argument against that is to make state schools so good that no one wants or needs to send their children privately. I appreciate it might be a kind of cultural choice for many, in that that's what they've had, or they want their children to board, or we've gone to Harrow for five generations and therefore so will my grandchildren type attitude. But that policy, it once again ingrains this attitude of privilege bad, poverty good, you know, you're on the right side of argument, on the wrong side. On that Politics Live panel, you know, I felt like turning around and saying, okay, so we're just saying all workers are good and all bosses are bad. Is this really this lowest common denominator nonsense? You know, because actually a lot of bosses create a great deal of wealth which employs people. I then thought the argument was so facile, in the sense of the European Convention on Human Rights gives parents the right to choose their education and protects the human rights of all children. I was saying there are 650,000 privately educated children. What about their human rights? Is my daughter, does she have less human rights? And then the MP was saying, well, she hasn't chosen that. I said, I am going through the process right now of where she's going to go to secondary school, and she wants to stay at her school. That is her choice. She is informed. She's 10 going 11.
I mean, I'm going to surprise you here, because I actually thought that Labour suggestion to ban private schools or abolish private schools was entirely ridiculous. And I have images in my head of the round table, you know, the sort of, right, OK, we need an education policy. Come on, we need an education policy. Right, what don't teachers like? Oh, Ofsted, get rid of that. Yeah, great. Now, next. I mean, obviously, I'm being facile here, but at the same time, it came across as very ill-informed, very naive, and quite patronising. And this whole idea, well, let's just get rid of independent schools, was ridiculous, because actually, I know there are all sorts of reasons why parents send their children to independent schools. And actually, well, you know, just the fact that we choose not to is by the by.
But is this narrative that is that you have a moral high ground or sense of self-righteousness if you've gone to a comprehensive?
I think my kids would be happier then.
No, but why is that the societal approach? You know, you have to be a bit careful if you're me and you're on panels. Oh, I was privately educated. I know a lot of idiots who were privately educated, and I know a lot of idiots who were comprehensively educated.
Well, because for people in certain economic circumstances, there is no choice. So it's the difference between choice and no choice, isn't it? Quite validly picked up when I tweeted about, actually, if people choose to send their children to independent schools, someone came back and said, well, actually, for many people, actually, there is no choice. So it's the choice versus the lack of choice, I suppose.
Well, I tell you what, private schools could do more. I think the statistic on the bursary offer, you know, it says that 10% of children have bursaries, but they don't have full bursaries. And have private schools got an onus to support more children from disadvantaged backgrounds?
Yes. Yeah, and I think that is a really interesting one for us. My school's part of a multi-academy trust, and we've got academy schools, we've got independent schools, and the opportunity there to share best practice cross-sector is enormous. And it definitely goes both ways. I think sometimes there's quite a patronising sense of, oh, independent schools could lend a sports field, or they could get some nice blazers in. It's not that at all. There is so much more to sharing best practice, and we take an awful lot of our approaches around teaching and learning and pedagogy straight from the state system, because some of the things they're doing are better than some things we were doing previously. And there's so much scope to develop people, but if we are going to have those, you know, a charity status and business rates, we have to earn those as an independent school. And I think there's some really important work to do around that impact you have in the community and that impact you have in a society. And I think the other point I was going to make is, like you were saying earlier, it's such a blunt tool to say all independents this, all states that, because there are some incredible independent schools and there are some awful ones, and there are some incredible state schools and there are some awful ones, and there's an awful lot of, in the middle of both. And the reason why people choose independent schools is huge. Then they should never ever have to justify that, in the same way you should never have to justify where you send your children. And I think we need to be much, much more aware of the nuances of each school, each family context, and each moral purpose that we lead our schools to.
Hasn't there been an amazing example of sharing best practice in your neck of the woods, with the head of Highgate School coming in and helping the Tottenham Hotspur sponsored academy, the free school that was set up? Set up as a sixth form. I did a story on it. It's one of the best performing. All the children there are from disadvantaged backgrounds. This is the other astonishing thing. And actually, again, another name that I'm going to drop the spoon in advance. Toby Young, I've said it. That's all I'm going to say.
You groaned. Clemmy groaned. That wasn't me.
Rab has just grabbed a dustbin lid to put over his head. But that free schools, he argues against private schools now, because he says actually the free school system proves one of the most successful sixth form is one, I think, in Hackney or similar, where they've just got 50% of the cohort into Oxford, if that's a mark of success. Again, a podcast for another day. And they're all from disadvantaged backgrounds. That is clearly showing the quality of the teaching. I mean, there needs to be good quality parenting involved in children, and parents can't devolve their responsibility. But my God, the teaching there must be astonishing to get these children these marks. The other thing I was going to say on that is, let's talk about the parents, because are you as teachers conscious that regardless of demographic, rich, poor, white, black, whatever, that the parental involvement in your pupils' lives is key to, and the way that they're brought up, and are they brought up to knuckle down and learn and not be absent? And if you say to them, do you know what, I'm going to predict you a C, but I reckon you could get a B, and the mum comes in and says, yes, he can, and supports him. This is surely hugely valuable.
It's huge, and there's a huge amount of data which says that actually kids' success has very little to do with the school, so why are we even here? It's actually a lot of it's to do with the upbringing of the parents. But actually, speaking of parenting, so how involved, we talk about this quite a lot. So our kids' teachers are very hands-on. They get, fair to say, plenty of meaningful homework, although I'll never forgive them for the Anderson shelter.
No.
How involved as a working mum are you?
I'm embarrassed because I really go into that Anderson shelter. That was my opportunity as what I feel is sometimes an absent mother. I was actually sewing with a machine loads of little pillow sandbags. I've
is
still
that
got
why you
it.
Felt bad? You've got yours a sewing not look machine. Like that.
Yeah, I used my sewing machine last night. Thank
I
you very much, Emma Kell.
I won a sewing machine in the local raffle, and I gave it to someone else.
I'd have had that. Anyway,
it would have just gathered
we
dust.
Digress. The parental involvement. Well, let's go back to my mum. I had a mum who was not parentally involved, I would say, at all. I was largely left to my own devices, and everything went okay. So I often reassure other mothers that beat themselves up constantly about not being as involved as they want to be because they're working full time or what have you, and say, do you know what? Good enough is good enough.
Yay,
you don't
that's
need
my
to be.
Mantra.
Hey, you see, so much in common across the divide. Good enough is good enough, and let's just stop beating ourselves up. I think that, I mean, my friends in the village take the mickey out of me because there was a period where I couldn't actually name my youngest children's teacher or teaching assistant, and I felt bad about that. I said to myself, I'd never try and miss, if there's assemblies or major things happening, and as we know, we're constantly on the football sideline, I'll try and watch as much of my kids' sport as I can. But I am a working mother full time and at the moment in the most ridiculous period of my career, and some things have had to slide.
You're not doing your nails in your spare time.
Funnily enough.
But do you not think that makes you a role model for your daughters?
I hope so. I mean, but then I reflect on my, you know, sometimes I think that I am going a bit over the top in a bid to not make my mother's mistakes. And I think that she would have benefited from being a working mother, there's no doubt about it. And so I am a bit of a workaholic. I think that's by nature, and it reflects on what I've discussed about how I was at school, like knuckle down. But at the same time, I think I'm trying to avoid making her mistakes. But I have to say to the children, you know what it's like with the children, you know, I do get, why aren't you here? Why aren't you home? Where are you going? Oh. Are you going out at night? Oh. And I am quite tough with them. Because this is the decision I've made. I don't think it's selfish to work. I enjoy work. It makes me the woman that I am. I'm not some harridan. If I'm not working, I dedicate most of my time to running around with the kids and spending quality time with them. I try and say to them, do you know what? You could have a stay-at-home mum who was a bad mum and, you know, came to stuff but wasn't right. You know, not... And also, I just hope that it's the experience we have. This is childbirth and our schooling. We have the mothers we have, and we grow up the mothers we have, and we'll have to reflect on that later. I don't resent my mother. I mean, in fact, my mother made me the resilient person I am today, and the person who's, you know, can be thrown into really chaotic situations and cope with it very easily.
Just about to do a TED talk on that in January about how parenting can impact how your children grow up. It's really important.
Yeah, and that's, of course, precisely what we bonded over. And I, you know, that's where, you know, I don't really care that you're a Tory. There you go, it's that there.
Because Camilla... I'm a Tory. It's funny.
It's very right-leaning.
I'm just not a Corbynista, I would say.
Oh, I'm not a Corbynista either. There you go.
I'm not a Swinsonian now after the whole revocation pledge. But let's, for God's sake, we've avoided Brexit. We're not getting into it in this podcast. May this be one rare podcast.
Where you don't talk about Brexit.
Where no one talks about Brexit.
Right, no Brexit. Right, if you were a teacher, what would you teach? And what would you be like?
I'd probably teach drama and...
Oh, you'd be good.
And I'd have a sideline. I would have a debating team. I would commit to having a debating team in a school. I love all that. Oh. And I would encourage the righties to take the left argument and the lefties to take the right argument and the pro-climate changers to be deniers. And I think that's the most healthy way to get children engaging with the arguments, but also engaging with each other. Have we had this period of... Is this what we're now seeing today, this kind of like disagreeable disagreeing? We should be able to disagree agreeably, and you have to instill that in schools, and you have to get kids making the arguments, engaging in the arguments, and actually, there's nothing better in life when we speak and you say, yeah, okay, I see where you're coming from. And I say, oh, that's a bloody good point. I hadn't considered that. That's what life's all about.
Is there anything you think that we don't teach in schools that should be taught? Is there another subject? Is there another club? What would it be if you could introduce one more thing into that national curriculum?
I think we should have life skills. I know we do have... Do we have general studies or equivalent? But I literally think we should have... This is how you do online banking. This is how you answer the telephone. This is how you greet an adult. This is, can you have half an hour a week to go and visit an elderly person? Can we do the practical stuff? This is how to repair a puncture on your bike. This is what happens if one of your classmates collapses. This is practical life skills, I think, are sadly absent in schools. But am I wrong? Maybe I'm a bit...
No, 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 they are. No, you're absolutely right. Life-saving, some kind of life-saving skills. In the meantime, your son is...
doing his own podcast into an HP bottle.
Yes, yes, no product
placement. And your daughter's doing exactly the same with the salt cellar.
Yes. In other words, I think they're all out of quinoa and buckwheat, darling. Yeah. So we better get ourselves down to the...
Other brown sauces are available.
I think I can see a whisper packet.
What, empty
how much whisper. Have you actually... Oh, and now he's...
Oh, my God.
Full,
oh, no, this is genuinely all...
He's drinking full-strength tango.
We're terrible parents. We've just ignored them for an hour. And then, anyway, thank you, Camilla.
Thank you, girls. It's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
I think it's safe to say the pleasure was all ours, Emma. I absolutely loved listening to Camilla talking about how she was raised and developed at school, and that sense of where there was a bit of support needed at home, school really stepped in and took on that pastoral lead and that role for Camilla. And I think it's really left me with some things to think about in terms of how do we wrap around those children that need that additional support and ensure that they come out of our system in the same way as Camilla has, which is confident, believing in herself, believing in her capabilities and being such a huge role model to other women and indeed other pupils around her. Just incredible.
And feisty enough to tell a teacher exactly where she wants to stick a banana. on a serious note, though, you know, that conversation about confidence was really interesting. And I felt like I was betraying my students a bit by talking about that lack of confidence in girls. But it'd be interesting to hear from listeners whether they have the same experience. But it can be a problem. And for someone who in so many ways was actually quite vulnerable, as she talks about herself, for Camilla to come out with such a sense of self-possession, humour, feist, pure feist. I'm just, you know, I've got a lot to think about in terms of how we actually instill that what the hell, let me at them attitude in our young people.
I would totally agree with that. I think a lot of schools, mine included, talk about character development and that hinterland of that wider character growth. But really, how do you take lip service and put it into action so that our pupils do come out of school sounding, looking and feeling a little bit more like Camilla?
Less of the words on wall. Stickability isn't a word, that to encourage character, and more of the really meaningful enactment of character and confidence, I think.
Some really interesting points unpicked today. If you want to carry that conversation on, don't forget we're both on Twitter. You can get me at cstewartshs.
And I'm at those that can. And there endeth the very first shiny new Clem & M podcast. How do you think it went?
I think Camilla was pretty fabulous. You and I, still a bit of work to do.
We'll get there. Wise words indeed. See you next time.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Clem & M podcast with Clemmy Stewart and Dr. Emma Kell. Special guest, Camilla Tomany. Produced by Rav Fatgarma. The Clem & M podcast is a Those That Can production.